Good evening. My name is Brandon Renaud. I'm the Utility Services Manager for City of Columbia Utilities. I'm happy to introduce Kate Vasquez of RRT. She's our consultant who's been working on a study of our recycling system. Kate will be doing a short presentation followed by an informal discussion so that the community can ask questions of her or staff. Off to her and let her give her presentation.
Water before I start. Thanks for coming out, everyone. I recognize a few of you from the workshop open house we had in March, so nice to see you again. As Brandon said, my name is Kate Vasquez. I'm Director of Planning and Advisory Services at RRT Design and Construction. We're a specialized solid waste consulting and engineering firm. We're out of New York, but we have offices across the US, and I'm outside Washington, DC. But I'm here to share with you this evening some of the data and information that we've been collecting since the project began in November. A major component of the project here in Columbia was to establish baseline data on which we could then build analysis, recommendations, projections for the future. In addition to the programs that you see on the screen, which I'll go through in a moment, we have also been doing some 20-year projections for waste volumes and composition. That information will allow us to make some projections about what different new or changed programs could achieve, and also where we have room for improvement right away, starting immediately, even without any program changes. All this information will be used to discuss the best and most impactful options for Columbia. So the first item is the MRF contamination study. And for those of you who may be unfamiliar with that abbreviation, that stands for a material recovery facility. That is the recycling plant that's located at the landfill where the materials are separated out into commodities to be sold. So in addition to a rigorous technical evaluation of the equipment at the MRF building, which was done in January and February, we had this MRF contamination study. This was did several different kinds of analyses on the material, both before it went over the processing equipment and afterwards. At present, the material is sorted into bunkers by type. And in this contamination study, we went into some of the bunkers and re-sorted them by hand to look at more in a more granular way what was there available and what could potentially be marketed that's not currently being marketed, and also to get additional information about the performance of the MRF equipment itself. The findings of that study as far as the MRF equipment itself, they were in agreement with the technical evaluation that was done of the equipment, which is that the equipment is at or near end of life, and it is at capacity. So even if recycling participation increased in Columbia, that facility is at its limit. The people who work there are doing an excellent job of producing excellent quality bales that they are selling readily, but the equipment itself is missing some of the material and losing it. So it's producing high value, but it's failing to capture a lot of recyclable materials. We'll look at that just a little bit in depth here. So I don't expect everybody to be able to read this whole table here in the presentation, although we can definitely talk about it more, or you could pause if you're watching the video. But the real positive thing here is that 82% of what was in the MRF was correct recycling. It was things that were supposed to be there, and 18% was incorrect recycling. Now, just on face value, those numbers, they aren't bad. If I went to a MRF and they said we have 18% contamination, I'd be like, well, that's not too bad. But it's important to note that that 18% includes several things. That includes something called outthrows. That is material that it is in the recycling program, but it went to the wrong side of the MRF. It, like paper in with the bottles and cans in with the paper. That also includes contamination, which is slightly different than residue. So sometimes people put something in there because it looks and feels like a recyclable, maybe a piece of black plastic or something like that. It's not egregiously wrong, and a modern MRF can easily sort those materials out. And then that is differentiated from residue, which is just food, diapers, stuff like that, that was not ever supposed to be in there, actual trash. So you can see that on the line that says contamination, 15%, it is heavily made up by residue, which is actual trash, but it also has a good percentage of film plastic. And that film plastic includes bags that people put their recycling in and includes the blue bags. So again, I don't necessarily consider that a true contamination, i.e. people putting junk in their recycling. Looking at the residential paper recycling, you can see it is showing a very low rate of contamination outthrows and residue. It's showing 95% being correct recyclables. That needs to be tempered a little bit by the fact that the material going over the paper side is kind of pre-screened in a way. For one thing, when they pick it up at the curb, if it's not paper that's not in a plastic bag, they tag and leave it. So right there's already some QA, QC before it even goes in the truck. And then when the paper gets dumped at the MRF, if the folks who work there see a bag of something, they throw it over to the container line. So again, the paper's getting kind of pre-screened. It is still the case, though, that the level of contamination is a lot lower on the paper. And mostly what's wrong in there is paper that people mistakenly or erroneously put in. Your current buyers don't want little plastic envelopes for little plastic windows and envelopes. So that's getting thrown out as residue. The thing is, that material is accepted by some mills. It's just the current purchasing doesn't. So this is all, there's a lot of context. I'm happy to talk to you about it more. But in essence, the residential customers are doing a pretty good job at what they put in their recycling and what is delivered to the MRF, the curbside customers. The extremely high quality of what is identified as coming from the residential routes kind of reinforces the theory that what contamination there is disproportionately coming from the drop-off centers and from the commercial customers, such as here in the downtown. That is not a causal finding. It just is in support of that idea. Like, well, if there's contamination, where is it coming from? It doesn't appear to be coming from the residential routes. And we also did confirm what the equipment evaluation found, which is that the program is losing quality tons due to the equipment in the MRF, just the nature of how the equipment is, not the effort or performance by the employees. So the next study that we worked on was a waste composition study. This was performed by a subcontractor with whom we have worked several times. They're well known in the industry for doing this kind of work. This was aimed at not necessarily identifying what is every single component by percentage in the trash, but more so to identify of what's delivered to the landfill, what could have gone in the recycling program, meaning the curbside, the business, or the drop-off centers, and also material for which there are diversion programs. Not necessarily something the city does, but the person who generated it could have taken a different action other than discarding it into the trash. It's a very scientific, stratified, weighted sampling program. That report is still, the final part of that report is still pending, but it is a statistically valid study. And the main result is that of the waste delivered to the landfill, about 20% of what was thrown away as trash could have gone into a recycling program, and about 45% could have been diverted in some other way. So we'll take a look at that. This slide, just real quick, breaks it down and shows that while it's about 20-21% from all sources, from the residential loads, 15% was recyclables. So a little bit better performance on the residential side. And from the commercial sector, about 25% of what was thrown away was recyclables. And that's pretty consistent with what we would expect to see across the board. The number one lost recyclable is cardboard, which is unfortunate because cardboard is so highly recyclable and reliably valuable. So this is definitely going to be an area where, now that we move past this data gathering stage and we really start looking at programs, focusing on how do we get that highly recyclable, highly valuable material not being thrown away, what's going on. So just to clarify, the figure that you're looking at here, this is the top 10 categories of waste on which we sorted, ranked by the most prevalent in the trash and down to number 10. So the most prevalent is food waste, and then contaminated film or other film, that's bags, that's very typical, and then going to cardboard. And then you can see that there's not another really good recyclable until you get down to mixed recyclable paper at less than 5% of the waste that was discarded into the landfill. So when we look at the materials that could have been recovered, we're talking about things that whoever generated it might have been able to do something besides discard it in the trash. Most of these aren't city programs. They're things that the person could have done on their own. They could have donated a textile. They could have composted at home or put it in their garbage disposal. They could have taken it to a recycler or made sure it got where it should have been, such as household hazardous waste, electronics, things like that. It would have been better that those are not going into disposal. And there's some figures there, just again breaking out by residential and commercial. They're not that dissimilar in this case from each other when it comes to the food waste being a little under 20%. And then the other recyclables. So of the material that was disposed of, 34 to 38% maybe didn't need to be. And that's what we're going to be looking at. How can we get more of that material to another home other than the landfill? The next data gathering activity I'm going to talk about is the curbside collection study. And this will be a little briefer because this is still ongoing. We're doing it in two two-week rounds, and that's because of it being every other week, so that we go on each route twice. So the second half started yesterday, so it's still in the middle of it, but that is designed to estimate a participation or set out rate at the residential curbside customers to see how many people are putting out material. And we're also getting qualitative observations of how much are they putting. I did want to clarify, this is not capturing any identifying data. This is literally yes, no, yes, no, yes, no on an app. Yes, quick question. Also capturing. At the drop-off centers?
Yeah.
We are not doing measurement of there. However, today we did some observations at those to kind of see what was going on, to look in the containers, just kind of watched for a little bit to see what was happening, what people were bringing in, you know, just kind of the flow of traffic. And again, no identifying information, nothing like that. We haven't had a lot of study aimed at really a deep dive on the drop-off centers, except that we did do visual assessment of several of those loads when they came to the MRF in the previous study I was describing. And that report goes into more detail about that. That's an excellent point. As you see in, as you see in the third box there, initial impressions are helping us learn. And if I can just, I'll click on to the next one. So far, it seems like set out is maybe less than we would have expected on an every other week program, because when it's only every other week, you expect to see a higher rate of set out than on a weekly program. And it's not being congruent with that. It's also being smaller set outs than we would expect. Maybe only one blue bag for 2 weeks. And so we've been trying to look at, well, why is that? And the Be Heard surveys, which we'll talk about in a minute, are showing us that a lot of people, like you just described, they go to the drop-off center on their off week, or if it's almost, it's just past their collection day and they have a high volume. So we are learning that anecdotally, and that is definitely going to be a caveat when we talk about what we observed at the curb. Another quick question.
Opposite issue.
Well, to address that usually is part of why we do it twice and far apart, to kind of correct for that. But what we're already finding is that probably this data is not going to be able to say this is a participation rate. It's going to be more useful of what is called a set out rate. So participation rate is slightly different. That is when does somebody ever put material out, like you say, or from time to time? And then set out rate is on any given day, how many times is the truck going to stop? So definitely this field data will give us a set out rate. We were hoping to get a participation rate. And this is why, but this is why we do other contexts. This is why we're doing surveys and stakeholder engagement, because what we have learned is that it is probably not going to yield as a participation in the recycling program number. Because for all the reasons we just, you know, kind of recapped, because we know that people are doing both at the same time. And so we want to make sure we're including all the context and not just let the numbers exist in a vacuum. Thank you for your questions. They're definitely important when we're looking at data. It doesn't exist all by itself in the universe. There's a people factor. And that really is, you know, what, like it says here on the presentation, all of these have to do with people's actions and what they're actually doing. So data gives us a lot of enumeration and description of that activity, but it has a larger context. And so we're keeping that in mind when we're looking at this. So that moves me to the stakeholder engagement. We had an open house in March, as I mentioned. We've had some meetings with city council members. Last time when we were here in March, we had some talks with them, one-on-ones, to ask some questions about different technical matters. We've also had meetings with several of the city agencies, including the Sustainability Agency and the Outreach Information Agencies. We have this open house here. This is our second public-facing activity. In addition to, there was one Be Heard survey already open to close, as I mentioned. And then there'll be another one coming shortly to ask some more about just actually what we were talking about. Well, when you don't have recycling at the curb, why is that? Right. And so trying to get some more information from people, that will be anecdotal and qualitative, but that will help us look at what's really the behavior and then how we can work with that and what people are already doing. Real briefly, the first Be Heard survey was designed to get just some real high-level information about how people currently use the program. And a lot of people were generally positive about their experience using the program. There wasn't a lot of negativity about having it dual stream, using the bags, not having a designated container, being able to use your paper bags or your boxes or what have you. The responses were really divided about carts. I know that is something folks have been talking a lot about here in Columbia. And there were several comments that indicated some misinformation that may be out there about what happens to the material that's delivered to the MRF. And so we're going to make sure that when we write about possible future education and outreach opportunities and recommendations for the city, that is included in them. And I just as a note, I was just reading that that's kind of a nationwide trend that folks that work in recycling and trash are seeing is some popular media is and maybe some mischaracterization. So we want to make sure that people know that the services that their city is providing them are doing what they say they're doing and understanding that to build confidence in the program. So I'm going to talk briefly about what's next for the project. Sorry, I'm running over a little bit. But we've been using the data combined with best practices and benchmarking to look at some options for Columbia. And that's what's really going to happen between now and the conclusion of the project at the end of August. I mentioned in an earlier slide that we've been projecting about the wasted recyclables delivered to the landfill. Both from the composition study and then from our waste projections that we make using our model. Last year, the material that was wasted there might have had a value of $2 million. Now, this is an order of magnitude type of projection, which means it's not rate setting or, you know, revenue estimating, but just an idea that it might have been sold for $2 million instead of, you know, lost forever as a resource. It's not It's not a marginal or inconsiderable amount of money. The biggest components, like I said, is one of the easiest ones to recycle is cardboard. So how do we get that cardboard where it belongs? So that's going to be a question that we're going to look at when we're writing our recommendations. Another example of what we'll do coming up is look at some what-ifs. So if the collection routes were more efficient, either by rerouting or different equipment, would that be able to impact the service level that you're currently experiencing? And if, for example, weekly returned or more even service could be returning, then would the drop-off centers be needed? Then if yes or no, because we know that the data is showing us the material from the drop-off centers is more contaminated, then we could expect a reduction in contamination. Now, this is a sample analysis. This is not written in stone. This is just an example of how the thought process goes. We're going to be continuing, like I said, as far as our work, we're going to be continuing to discuss, identify, and quantify the possibilities for Columbia. We have a pre-council scheduled for July 17th, maybe, I hope. I probably shouldn't have said that on the mic, but I know there's one in July we're on. I think it's the second one. And then the project is scheduled to finish at the end of August, likely with a final presentation early in September or the end of August. So we're on schedule for that. I appreciate you all being here. I'm going to go ahead and step off the mic so that we can talk more informally and more back and forth than this with the podium between us. But thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll be happy to talk with you now.